This is the biochemistry lecture for October
20, 2009. Okay, so today is October 20. All right. And we're talking about chapter 10, is that right? We're dealing with nucleic acids and nucleotides and nucleosides and all that kind of thing. And yes? Anything that goes on in here gets recorded. Yeah. Yes, it did, absolutely. I don't know how to stop. It's picking up whatever ambience in the room. Now, you're going to be pretty far away. You're going to be pretty echoey.
Is it recording right now?
Yes, it is. Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Yay, you're welcome. I'm glad to know that you're alive today. All right, so am I. But let's begin with a word of prayer, shall we? Dear Lord, we thank you for each person here. We thank you for the good day we're going to have. We thank you for the minds that we were given, that we're able to think and to do and be of service and be to others and to be a positive part of today's world. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. All right, well, let's take a look at it. We're looking at slide number 9 in chapter 10, properties of pyrimidines and purines. The only thing that I really care about here is the strong absorbance of ultraviolet light. Because of the aromatic nature of the purine and adenine, both of those types of molecules will absorb strongly in the ultraviolet region. The next slide deals with the ketoenolactotomerism of uracil. I don't particularly care, although it is interesting. Why is this thing right here called a lactam? Why is that called a lactam? What is that? How is that? What is it? Double bonded O's, you're talking about here? Yeah, well, not exactly. We know that we recognize what an ester is that correct? C double bond O dash something. This is the ester. But if you have a cyclic ester, the cyclic ester is given another name. Do you remember? Anybody remember what that cyclic ester name is? Lactone. Correct. Lactone. If you replace the oxygen, the singly bonded oxygen of that cyclic ester with a nitrogen, then you get a lactam. And so that's where the term lactam comes. It's a cyclic ester. And there's actually a couple of them in there. And that's a trivial thing I would need for you to just recall from your organic chemistry. Don't worry about the lactam. Again, you could have a ketoenal form of the purine as well. This particular diagram is very, very, well, the ultraviolet absorption spectrum of common ribonucleotides. So you have the AMP, UMP, CMP, GMP. And notice where it strongly absorbs, no matter what the pH, it strongly absorbs pretty close to what wavelength? What wavelength would you call that? Between what? About 260, maybe 280? Maybe 250, between 250 and 280 nanometers. Where does ultraviolet begin? What frequency does ultraviolet begin, or what wavelength does ultraviolet begin? What did you say? 4? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, about 400. Yeah, it varies because it's not a hard and fast rule where it begins, but around 400, 350, this kind of thing, is where ultraviolet wavelength begins. And that's important because glass does not transmit ultraviolet. So when you're dealing with an ultraviolet spectrophotometer, you typically have to use quartz cuvettes. Not plastic, not glass, but quartz. And that begins about 400 nanometers. So this demonstrates that there is, of course, some dependence on, I mean, where the wavelength is that strongly absorbs. And let's see here, what else? You can see there's some pH dependency on it. And this has to do with the keto-enotautomerism of the compounds. Sometimes the tautomeric relationship changes where it absorbs and so on. Now, we've been looking at the nucleic acids themselves, but what is a nucleoside? Well, nucleoside typically are bases that are linked to a sugar. Bases to a link to a sugar. Now, wait a minute. Okay, let's see. We just went from a base. Now, why is this a base? Why are these things bases in terms of their acid-base behavior? Why do they have a lot of basic characteristics to it? Because of all the nitrogen. Exactly right. Because of all the nitrogens here, they are originally called bases. Bases. But you will see eventually we're going to add phosphate to it, and it changes their acid-base characteristic from being basic to being acidic. And we'll see that here. But in the meantime, we're going to add a unit to the base, and it's going to be a sugar. Typically, sugars are pentoses. You got the D-ribose in RNA and deoxyribose in DNA. Of course, the difference is that 2' hydroxy versus a 2' hydrogen. It affects the secondary structure and chemical stability. So right in here it says the difference affects secondary structure and put in, right in, chemical stability. When it says stability, it means chemical stability. It's going to be more stable over the long term and not be quite so easily attacked by acids and bases to hydrolyze that structure. So it's a chemical stability. Here's the structure of D-ribose in the Fischer form, and there it is in the Hayworth form, and there it is. There's the deoxyribose in the Fischer, and there it is in the Hayworth projection. You certainly should be able to distinguish the difference between the ribose form and the deoxyribose form in the cyclic structures that you see there. So you need to be able to tell me the difference between these two things. The base is linked via what they know is a glycosidic bond. The carbon to glycosidic bond is anomeric. Let's go take a look at what that means. So typically, the base is attached to that anomeric carbon, carbon number one of the Hayworth projection. And you find there, then you could have that then in the beta form, like it is here, shown in beta. Theoretically, at least, you could have an alpha form, in which the sugar is below, or the base is below that. But you never see it that way. Let's go back up the truck here. You put an adenine at the end of the name, or an osine and then a purine. The conformation can be syn or anti. And, of course, the sugars make it more water-soluble. With the reason, of course, with all those hydroxy groups on there, a nucleoside is more water soluble than the original base. Notice here they kind of, I don't really care. They talk about syn and anti. That's an idea that is more detailed than I want to get involved with. Again, here you can see the various sugars involved with this. They're all riboses. So this is all used in RNA. You're going to need to be able to identify these by matching as well. You're going to need to be able to identify these by matching as well. Everything but inosine, you don't need to worry about inosine. It's an uncommon nucleoside. So all these five different ribonucleotides. And here's a graph that talks about syn versus anti. I don't care. We can simply cross that out. All right, so you're copying down. So the next one, slide 18, you can simply say skip. I don't care about syn and anti. If you put a phosphate on the sugar, you then get a nucleotide phosphate, or this is called nucleotide phosphate's redundant, nucleotide. So you got the base, then you got the nucleoside, and then you get the nucleotide, and the tide is the complete unit. That's the monomer that makes the polymer of RNA and DNA. And that's our, and you see that right here. Here is that monophosphate, guanosine monophosphate, cytidine monophosphate, uridine. All of these have these highly negative charges right here. So you put a phosphate on the 5 position of the sugar, and suddenly it changes the chemical characteristic away from being a base to being a fairly strong acid. So these are now called nucleic acids or nucleotides. Nucleotides. And they have a significant acidic component to it because the phosphate anion is a part of a pretty strong acid. All right, so we now have nucleotides and nucleosides and nucleic acid bases, and we know the fact that nucleotides with the phosphate are fairly good acids. All right, now, the 5' triphosphates are carrier of energy, huh? Well, you're familiar with ATP. What is ATP? Thank you very much. But you'll find in metabolism there's also lots of GTP and CTP and UTP. And UTP, we're going to find out when we get into carbohydrate metabolism and so on, is used to transfer to make galactose into glucose using a UTP epimerase. So ATP is the central, GTP is protein, CTP drives lipid synthesis. This is a fairly broad and simplified version of what all these different trinucleotides do, triphosphonucleotides, whatever, triphosphates. But ATP, of course, is predominantly the big one, the big kahuna. Then I need for you to be able to, well, probably by matching again the structures of the cyclic AMP and cyclic GMP, I want you to be able to identify that in a matching situation. Cyclic AMP is in a very, very important second messenger in the cell, and I need for you to be able to identify it. For those of you who've had caffeine this morning, anybody had a little caffeine this morning already? Help them out, help themselves out a little bit? Nobody? Oh, okay. I was going to say at least one. The caffeine that you're consuming actually turns out to be a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, which in part prevents that ring from being broken right there, and therefore temporarily increases the amount of cyclic AMP in a lot of cells in your body. And that stimulates the cells, stimulates the nerve tissues as well, gives you a sense of alertness, temporarily though. The dirty little secret about caffeine is the fact that there is no dirty little secret about caffeine, because humans have been dosing themselves for hundreds of years, millions of times a day with caffeine, and they've not linked one chronic illness to caffeine use. No cancer, no nerve damage, no nothing. So, now, I understand, I mean, you're going to be temporary, there are going to be temporary effects. You're going to get heart palpitations for some people who are susceptible. Some of the overuse of caffeine can give you the shakes as the body tries to deal with having too much cyclic AMP, constantly being there. But in terms of long-term, chronic problems, they haven't found any. Sorry. I can guarantee you that if there were any, we would know about it. Because, like I said, every day, millions, perhaps billions of people around the world dose themselves with caffeine. And if there were any epidemiological effects from it, we'd see it. All right. What are nucleic acids? Polymers linked 5' to 3' diester bridges, phosphodiester bridges. Ribonucleic acid, deoxyribonucleic acid, know the shorthand notations. Sequences always reads 5' to 3'. What does the prime mean? Well, let's go back here. Positions on the bases are simply given numbers. Position number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Positions on the sugars, however, have that prime notation. So when they're talking about 5' to 3', they're talking about the chain moves through the 5' carbon, through the 4' carbon, through the 3' carbon, and on to another phosphate. So that's where the polymerization occurs, is between the 5' and the 3' of the sugar, and nowhere else. All right. This corresponds to N to C in proteins. That's why we draw N is always on the left, and the carboxylic acid terminus is always on the right. There are two types, classes of nucleic acid, DNA. There's one type and one purpose. What do you think the one purpose of DNA is? Quickly, what's the dogma say that it is? Information storage. And RNA, well, there's several different purposes for that. There is carrying the message, carrying the amino acids, provides a basis for structure and function of ribosomes, which helps interpret between RNA and proteins. There's a lot. A ribosomal DNA, RNA has a lot of purposes. DNA only has one. How can you tell one is RNA and one is DNA? And I don't know why the D's are missing here. Don't you think that's interesting? How can you tell which one is which, and why? How can you tell it? There should be two ways you can tell that one's DNA and one's RNA. And what is it? What are the two ways? What? Uracil is in the what? RNA. What's the other distinctive difference between DNA and RNA? The what? The carbon on the what? Pentose sugar. Which carbon? Number 2. So look at there. There's number carbon number 5, carbon number 4, carbon number 3, carbon number 2 in RNA has a what? Hydroxy. Carbon number 2 in the DNA has a what? Hydrogen. So there should be two ways to distinguish between RNA and DNA. Does everybody understand that? Can everybody do that? Everybody understands that they're going to be expected to know how to do that? I say that. Excellent. Good. This is shorthand. This is shorthand for making the polymer. Shorthand for making the polymer. This is a kind of a cute way of doing it here. Where the sugar is all the sticks and the round dots at the top are all the nucleic acid bases. And you can see here you have a 5' and a 3', or sometimes they just simply have it 5' to 3' like this, and they don't show the 5' and 3'. So the diagonal line represents a phosphodiester linkage between the 5' and the 3'. So this tells you that it is DNA or RNA. In this case, you can tell it's DNA because it does not show any uracil. All right. What are the different classes of nucleic acids? There's messenger RNA, ribosomal DNA, transfer DNA, small nuclear RNA, small non-coding RNAs. There's also silencing siRNAs. That's a new one that's come up recent years, silence RNA. All right, so the DNA double helix. The DNA double helix. Base pairs arise from hydrogen bond. Erwin Chargaff had the pairing data, but didn't understand its implications. Rosalind Franklin's X-ray fiber diffraction data was crucial. Francis Crick knew it was a helix. James Watson figured out the hydrogen bonds. Why did not Rosalind Franklin get the Nobel Prize as well? She did. Yeah. Should she have gotten it? Absolutely. What did you say? I don't even want to know. At any rate, okay. Yes, well, I'm dying up here. I don't know if you've noticed that. Well, it just seems like now that I'm recording this, everybody's really quiet, a little on edge. Is that right?
No.
No? Don't care? Yes, or actually more so. No, I'm just teasing. Okay. At any rate, so Francis Crick, I know of a friend who has his picture taken with Watson and who thinks that it's either Crick or Watson are kind of as a pompous windbag in some respect. Who was it?
Watson.
It's Watson. Why do you, have you heard that too? Oh, you heard him speak once? Where?
No, I'm like, you can watch his different.
You can watch, yeah. And that's what they say. Yeah. Well, I'm hoping to become famous enough to be able to become a pompous oaf. I think I've got the pompous oaf written and gotten down pretty well. I just need to get the famous part of it. I know what I'll do. I'll launch a hydrogen balloon into the air and claim my child is on it. Or maybe one of you. Is that okay? That's the kind of thing that would get my name on television. Yes. Absolutely. Then I can be... What?
Do it to Gretchen.
Do it to Gretchen. There you go. That's right. Oh, that's okay. Well, the nice thing about Gretchen is she's used to hiding in an attic. So she would not feel all that bad about... I have no idea what that means, but anyway. Yeah. And by the way, by recording all this, these jokes will be in perpetuity. Yes, exactly. Post them on Facebook, if you'd like. Yeah. Yeah. Send the link to all your friends. Listen to this lecture. It's fabulous. All right. So, anti-parallel nature of DNA. What that means is when DNA forms a polymer, the hydrogen linkage between the AT forms and the GC forms allow it to line up only if the 5' to 3' direction on one of the two bands is in opposition or anti-parallel to the 5' to 3' of the other. So it's anti-parallel double helix in which the 5' and 3' directions are opposite. But notice the kinds of double bonds that you can form here. The number of hydrogen bonds for AT and GC are different. That has a definite physical characteristic difference. So double bond is anti-parallel. These are the Watson-Crick pairs. Again, I do not need for you to memorize this diagram here, nor the previous diagram. However, I do want you to know that AT only has how many hydrogen bonds? Two. But the GC pair has how many?
Three.
That has distinct melting temperature implications, strength of the helix implications. But the exact nature of the angles and the bond distances, and I don't care. Sorry. All right. Now, having that base pair, that mirror image, immediately comes up with how you make duplications of the DNA. And so daughter DNA that's being made down here is a mirror image of each of the two pairs or each of the two strands, and therefore that's how you easily make how you duplicate DNA. You simply make a mirror image of each of the two strands, and bingo, you've got an exact copy of the original. Let's see here. All this is a nice trivial piece of information. I think we may get done. Well, maybe not. With this, what do I care about? The structure of DNA... Well, the DNA can be folded and refolded and folded again so that it can fit into extremely small piece. The physical length of your DNA in each of your cells, if stretched out, is about a meter long. So each of your cells contains an entire copy of the DNA for your body. And but in eukaryotes, it's wrapped around histones to form these nucleosomes to allow for compact folding. All right, what's messenger RNA? What's messenger RNA? What's the difference between messenger RNA of a prokaryote versus a eukaryote? What's the main difference between prokaryotic messenger RNA and eukaryotic messenger RNA? Well, the primary difference is the following. In prokaryotes, as it's listed here, the messenger RNA contain the information for many proteins. A single messenger contain the proteins, contains information for many proteins. In eukaryotic system, the messenger RNA only contains the information for one protein. One protein. And that's interesting. But, of course, the messenger RNA in eukaryotes is also composed of introns and exons. Exons. So, just for those of you who are familiar with this, let's just review. The intron and the exon sequences within a eukaryotic messenger RNA, which one, the intron or the exon, is kept for codon? For codon. Yeah, the exon is expressed. What is the intron actually supposed to represent? What is that supposed to... What? Yeah, what is excised? It's supposed to mean intervening sequences. Intervene. You get in between things. The cops intervened in the riot and prevented more damage. So the intervening, the intron, is what's cut out. The exon, as it says, is expressed. Is that correct? Yeah. Okay. Let's take a look at the models here. It's very common. Here is a prokaryotic model. The RNA polymerase, which is used to duplicate the RNA, goes along the DNA, produces the messenger RNA, and then these ribosomes come along and continually duplicate all the different proteins that are on that messenger RNA. This model has been proven to be true in many, many circumstances, and you can actually see electron micrographs of this kind of thing happening. But the regulation of that process is extraordinarily complicated, even for a prokaryotic material. It's even more complicated for eukaryotic systems, and it defies comprehension that people would claim that this occurs through random processes. Okay, so you have the DNA segment that's got the exon, which is the expressed sequences, the intron, which are the intervening sequences, which are not duplicated. And so that's expressed. Messenger is made. It's then spliced, so the exons are together, and then the protein is translated from that. That's just a quick, in general, view of it. So, for eukaryotic messenger RNA, there is major pieces that we need to talk about. First of all, the end of the messenger RNA has a poly-A sequence. At the end of it, there is a 5' cap that's at the beginning of the messenger RNA that keeps it chemically stable and works with the recognition of it. There, of course, is the intron and the exon. The poly-A tail apparently is related to stability of the messenger RNA. As the messenger RNA gets duplicated or translated, more and more of that tail is eventually cleaved off, and if it reaches a certain limit, the whole messenger RNA is destroyed, and splicing, and we've talked about, finally produces a messenger RNA without introns. We are not going to get into the details of splicing today or in this particular chapter that I know of. Ribosomal RNA, this acts as, it's about 2/3 RNA, 1/3 protein. And it's used to help translate the intermediate between ribosomes and proteins. Kind of have both. Now, what in the world is this for? Prokaryotic ribosomes and eukaryotic ribosomes. What do I need for you to know? Can someone tell me what the S means in that 70S and the 80S? Can someone tell me what that means? No, actually not subunit. Svenberg units. Svenberg units. Sven. It's Swedish, like the Swedish chef. Svenberg. I think it's with an R. Unit. The unit of density related to centrifugation. That's how it was originally developed. Svenberg unit. Related to the density as measured by centrifugation or related to centrifugation. So these prokaryotic ribosomes and eukaryotes were first isolated using centrifugation. Hours and hours and hours of high-speed centrifugation. And were given that value. When they dissociated it, and when they dissociated the primary ribosome and spun it again and did centrifugation, they realized the subunits had slightly different Svenberg units. The Svenberg unit is not related specifically to the molecular weight. It's related specifically to the density. Now, density in this case is not additive. Density is not additive. So Svenberg units are not additive. That's why you can have a 70S whole, but a 30 and 50S subunit. Obviously, 30 and 50 don't add up to 70, but that's all right because centrifugation processes are not linear per se. So what I need for you to know, of course, prokaryotic ribosomes, that is the material or protein that changes messenger RNA into protein. It's called 70S with two subunits of 30S and 50S. Same thing with the eukaryotic 80S, 40S, and 60S. The details here about the number of nucleotides and proteins is irrelevant. Just the top half of this and just the S's and not the molecular weights. Don't worry about the molecular weights. I just want you to know that if they're talking about a 70S ribosome, they're talking about Svenberg units. Also, what kind of ribosome? Prokaryotic or eukaryotic? 70S is what? Prokaryotic. 80S is what? Eukaryotic. And don't forget it. And also the subunits. A 40S and a 60S are only linked to eukaryotic, whereas in 30 and 50 are related to prokaryotic. Don't forget it. All right. Why does DNA contain thymine? Because cytosine will spontaneously deaminate. And so you don't want that to happen. You'll end up getting an incorrect sequence in that particular line. And I'm going to have another 4 minutes. We'll be done. Then we'll have the little quiz. It also would be helpful to the repair enzymes couldn't tell the difference between a regular U and a mutant U. So they take that thymine and put it in its place. You can see the difference there. So you can see the difference between cytosine and uracil, what the deamination does. And the 5-methyl group prevents that. Why is DNA deoxying RNA? Make it more susceptible to chemical hydrolysis. DNA lacking the 2-hydroxy makes it more stable. RNA is designed to be used and then broken down. And then hydrolysis of nucleic acids. I don't really see the purpose in this. You don't typically use this. I don't care, so we can skip this part right here. Hydrolysis of nucleic acids. This number 43 we can skip as well. Skip that. Hydrolysis, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's not that relevant. Number 44 we can skip. Number 45, what we're going to do here is we will stop right here in the restriction enzymes and we'll continue this tomorrow. I'll need to upload chapter 11. And then we'll be moving on. We're going to start making some serious moves here, ladies and gentlemen. So please read chapter 11. Yes.